Genesis 28, and we're going to read verse 15 to just kind of remind us where we've been. And it says, this is God speaking, by the way. He says, "Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." I'm a bit of a cereal connoisseur, if there is such a thing. The favorite in our house is probably, at least recently, has been Lucky Charms, like to the point that we're buying like the 2-pound bags at Walmart once a week. I have a question. When you pour your child a bowl of Lucky Charms, how many marshmallows is inappropriate to take off the top? Because in the morning, I'll be pouring a bowl for my 5-year-old son, Ethan, and he'll come around the corner and he'll say, "Daddy, don't eat my marshmallows." Lucky Charms. It's Lucky Charms. It's got these, the non-marshmallow parts at least, are supposed to be these little trinket-type things that remind us of cultural superstitions that could bring us good luck. They're Lucky Charms. And of course, it's that time of the year where you hear about the luck of the Irish, St. Patrick's Day just passing us. But we know, as believers, at least we should, that luck is a superstition. And in this passage this morning, there is a lot of superstition and misplaced cultural beliefs going on here. So when we get to the end of our passage this morning, Jacob's going to look back, because we're going to cover a period of 20 years this morning. He's going to be able to look back, and he's going to acknowledge that this was not luck. It was God. So what has happened is that Jacob has tricked his twin brother, but even more than that, Jacob tricked his father into giving him the blessing. And in that culture, if you were to backstab or to trick your father, that was a huge deal. I mean, even earlier in Genesis, Ham had some way undermined Noah, and it brought a curse on his son. So we come here to chapter 29, where we'll be this morning, and Jacob is a runaway. He is running for safety from his brother Esau, but God came to him at Bethel and told him that he was going to be with him, even while he was outside of the land, but he would bring him back to the land. So this morning, these three chapters that we're going to cover, Jacob is pictured as an exile out of the land, because God has promised the land to Abraham and his descendants. In the portion of Scripture we're going to see this morning, there is greed, there is deceit, there is superstition, and like Pastor Jared talked about it last week, these are things that we don't do, okay? There's not a lot of, here, do this and you will be blessed in these passages. But our main idea this morning is that God provides undeserved favor. Pastor Jared talked about that at the end of the passage last week, how Jacob was a runaway, but God gave him undeserved favor. And it is God, it is his undeserved favor that's going to bless Jacob through these 20 years. So, first of all, it is God's undeserved favor that gives provision. It is God's undeserved favor that gives provision. Chapter 29, verse 1. We'll have to read quickly, speak quickly, listen quickly this morning. "Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. As he looked, he saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large. And when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well." So Jacob goes northeast, back to where Abraham came from, back to where his mother was from, and he finds a well, probably not the same well that Abraham's servant found Rebecca at, but at this well, there's some shepherds that are hanging out. There's a big stone that is covering the well because they're waiting for the rest of the shepherds to come, so they can all at one time hoist this big stone off of the mouth of this well and then water their sheep. So Jacob strikes up this conversation with the shepherds that are there. In verse 4, Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where do you come from?" They said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" That's his uncle. They said, "We know him." He said to them, "Is it well with him?" They said, "It is well. And see," or look, "Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep." So Rachel is a shepherdess. We don't know how old she is here. She might be a teenage girl, likely, but she is a shepherdess, which is not unheard of in that culture. Verse 7, he said, "Behold, it is still the high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." So I think what Jacob is doing is that he sees Rachel coming, and he's trying to get them out of there so he can have a conversation with her. But they say, "No, we wait for all the shepherds to come. That's why we're hanging out here until everybody gets here so we can lift the stone off the mouth of the well." Verse 9, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Now, as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. So usually a task that took a bunch of different guys to do, Jacob performed by himself. We don't know if this is a miraculous feat of strength or if this is just a feat of stupidity of a testosterone-driven man to impress Rachel. But nevertheless, he removes the stone by himself. Verse 11, it says, "Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud, and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father." So she goes and tells her father that Laban, his nephew, is in town, and then Laban comes and runs to greet him. And Jacob spends about a month with Laban and his family and his household, and after about a month's time, they realize this is going to go on for longer term. And so they work out an arrangement. And in these negotiations, Jacob has an idea. He finds Rachel very attractive, so he offers to work 7 years for the hand of Rachel so he can marry her. Laban agrees to this, but he's going to have some shady things going on before it's all said and done. And so Jacob does indeed work for Laban, for Rachel, for 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, he comes up to Laban. He says, "All right, boss, uncle, where is my wife? It's been 7 years." And he says, okay. So they have a feast. In that culture, apparently, what they would do is they would have a big feast. And then that first night, the marriage would be consummated, and then there would be an ongoing feast that would happen the rest of the week. So, but the text says that at the end of the day, Laban brings his daughter to Jacob, but he brings Leah, the older daughter. And we don't know anything about Leah yet, except that the text says that she is tender-eyed. And so the commentators wonder, what does tender-eyed mean? Does that mean she had poor eyesight? Does that mean that tender eyes mean she had attractive eyes? But the text is actually drawing a physical contrast in the two. So tender-eyed is a way of saying she was nice. She's real nice. But Jacob, they consummate the marriage, and in the morning, Jacob doesn't, all through the night, Jacob doesn't realize it's Leah until the morning. Maybe some alcohol involved. Maybe cultural traditions of the wife actually remaining veiled that first night. But regardless, Jacob has no idea what's going on until the morning. So Laban successfully pulled this switcheroo. And what is happening, and we have irony, is that the deceiver, Jacob, who deceived his brother, who deceived his father, has now himself been deceived. And so when he goes and he confronts Laban about this, Laban's justification is, well, it's not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. He justifies it by this cultural belief, which in 7 years, Jacob probably should have known. Regardless, everybody understands the sanctity of marriage. Even in that culture, they understand what's done is done. She is now his wife. So what happens is Laban knows that Jacob is a man in love. And what he now does is he's going to leverage that, manipulate the situation, and get this good, strong worker to work 7 more years for him. So the agreement that they come to now is that Jacob agrees to work 7 more years in exchange for Rachel. And Laban just asked, just finish this week, which was probably the week of the marriage feast. Let Leah have her place in the sun for a week, and then you can have Rachel, as long as you promise to work these 7 more years for me. And Rachel, or Jacob, agreed to that. But the text says that once Rachel is given to him, that he loved Rachel more than Leah. Okay, so in one quick chapter, we are seeing God's provision. Like I said, there's a lot of crazy things that are going to happen in this portion of Scripture. But what we see is in God's sovereignty, even through the weakness and dysfunction of this family and the personalities involved, that God has provided Jacob with at least 2 things. He's provided him with a refuge, a place of refuge, and a family. And by the way, when we come to Christ, those are the things God has provided for us. In Christ, we have a refuge, we have a family. But God is answering Jacob's prayers that he prayed back in chapter 28, verses 20, at the end of the Bethel episode. There in chapter 28, verse 20, he says, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God.'" And God is showing Jacob that he can be trusted. He is providing for Jacob. Now, if you think what we've read here in chapter 29 is dysfunctional, cousins marrying each other, multiple wives, a manipulative father-in-law, if you think all of that is dysfunctional, you haven't seen anything yet. Because this is going to rival any episode of Jerry Springer that you have ever seen. And I know some of you have seen Jerry Springer, so don't act so high and mighty, okay? Number 2, it is God's favor, undeserved favor that he places on us that gives us provision, but also, secondly, gives us prosperity. Prosperity. Verse 31 of chapter 29. It says, "When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." Now, when it says here that Leah was hated, it doesn't mean that Jacob was out to get her or that he was trying to hire people to kill her off. It's the law of comparison that he loves and he adores Rachel. That's the love of his life. And Leah kind of exists. But it says, when Yahweh saw that, He opened Leah's womb. Verse 32, and Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, for now my husband will love me. It's a pathetic, pitiful scene here for Leah. She's not loved. Her father has leveraged her for a workman. And when she has this son, she actually names him Reuben, which in literally in Hebrew it means look, a son. And saying, I've had a son now for you, Jacob. Give me some attention. Give me some affection. But it doesn't stop there. God continually opens the womb and she conceives again. She has a second son whose name she names Simeon, which means to hear. Because it says in the text, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also. Still starving for affection. And you can see this in the way she names the kids. She has a third son. She names him Levi. Because now this time my husband will be attached to me. Because I have borne him three sons. But is that going to happen? No, it's not. And she has a fourth son, who this time she names Judah, which means praise. Because she seems to have a little bit of illumination here to realize that God is blessing her, whether she has Jacob's affection or not. And she says, this time, I will praise the Lord. I will praise Yahweh. So God saw Leah in the situation that she was in. And Leah was not forgotten. Although Rachel was the loved wife, Leah is the one who's going to give birth to Levi, the tribe of Levi, and the tribe of Judah, which would be the most exalted tribes out of all of Jacob's sons. Levi would produce Moses and the priesthood. Judah, of course, would produce King David, and the one that King David even foreshadowed, Jesus Christ, the Messiah. Now in chapter 30, verses 1, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. Well, who could imagine that something like that would happen when somebody has more than one wife? She said to Jacob, give me children or I shall die. Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? David says, all right, I'm already doing my part. What else do you want me to do? This is up to God. Rachel had the husband, but wanted the kids. Leah had the kids, but wanted the husband. Arnold Frutenbaum points out about this passage in Rachel wanting these kids and this brash expression, give me kids or I die. He points out the irony. He says, Rachel claimed that she would die if she did not have children, but in fact, she would later die giving birth to Benjamin. And Jacob's whole life here up to this point, and even later, is characterized by family tension. Now, a lot of that was because his mom and dad had favorites. And then he, of course, swindled his brother, swindled his father. And then you have this friction here with his in-laws and his two wives. And then even later, as we go through the rest of Genesis, we're going to see huge tension with his sons. It characterizes his whole life. Nevertheless, God uses all of these details. And don't forget that in the beginning, God made them male and female, one man, one woman. And this is a perversion of God's design. And so this whole retelling of this story, it's going to serve as a warning against polygamy to the later generations. And one of the reasons that it was forbidden in the law. Verse 3, it says, then she said, Rachel, because she still can't have kids, she has this bright idea. Then she said, here's my servant, Bilhah. Wait a second, does this sound familiar? Remember Abraham and Sarai and Hagar? Then she said, here's my servant Bilhah. Go into her, euphemism, so that she may give birth on my behalf, that even I may have children through her. So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. It's just remarkable this whole time. Jacob's just like, oh, okay, the whole time. So Rachel, she's not going to be outdone by Leah. She wants to have kids so bad that her handmaiden, which was a gift from her father when she got married, just like Leah was given a handmaiden when she got married, she gives this handmaiden over to Jacob so they can conceive a child and the child actually be possessed or identified with Rachel. And indeed, this servant woman, she has two sons. The first son she names, Rachel names Dan, which means he judges. She says, God has seen my affliction and judged between me and my sister. The second one is called Naphtali, means wrestler or a wrestling, communicating that tension that has been going on. Go down to verse 9 in this chapter. Not to be outdone, when Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children, she took her servant, Zilpah, and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And now Zilpah, Leah's handmaid, is going to conceive and have two more children for Jacob. Gad, who means good fortune or luck, and Asher, which means happy. Look at verse 14. In the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes, the oldest son, Leah's first son, Jacob's first son. He went out and he found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? Rachel said, then he, talking about Jacob, then he may lie with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes. When Jacob came from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. Jacob again. So he lay with her that night. And God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me my wages because I gave my servant to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. Issachar means hired out. Now mandrakes, I may have a picture of this on here because we don't have them around here. They do exist in the Mediterranean. Mandrakes were kind of known as an aphrodisiac, but also there was this superstitious belief that they could help a woman's fertility. The fruit on mandrakes bloom, it makes these little yellow fruits that look like apples. And in fact, because of these connotations that were associated with mandrakes, the Greeks would later call them love apples. The irony here in this passage is that it is Leah's son who finds the mandrakes, and Rachel gets wind of this and says, hey, let me have those mandrakes, maybe it will help me conceive. And she says, if you give me these mandrakes, you can spend the night with Jacob tonight. And Leah agrees to this. And the irony of the thing is that Leah gives up the mandrakes and still conceives. Rachel, who acquires the mandrakes, still has trouble conceiving. And then Leah, she has her son Issachar, and she's going to have another son who she's going to name Zebulun. which means honored. And not only that, it mentions that she now has a daughter, Dinah. This is going to foreshadow a narrative that's going to happen here in a few chapters. Dinah's not going to be super important to what's going on right here, and even with tribal history, the way it was. But we are going to see Dinah again here in a little bit. Look at verse 22 of chapter 30. It says, "Then God remembered Rachel." This isn't God did not actually forget. This is an anthropomorphism. God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach." And she called his name Joseph, saying, "May the Lord add to me another son." So all through Genesis, there is this sub-theme that it is the Lord who controls the womb, the fruit of the womb. And the more we see Rachel, the less sympathetic I feel for her. She doesn't really seem like that great of a person. In fact, when she finally does have a son, she names him Joseph, which means he adds. And the description here is, "May the Lord add to me another son." It's not Thanksgiving. It's, "One more, please. I'll take another. Yes, I'll have another." So, Jacob here, what is happening is the narrator is recounting for us how Jacob became so blessed. When you read the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, you have to keep something in mind. It's these terms, prescriptive and descriptive. All right? Prescriptive means that you look at something and you're meant to copy a behavior. So prescriptive would look at this passage in Genesis and says, "Oh, this is what we're supposed to do." There's prescriptive and there's descriptive, okay? Which is what's going on here. The descriptive just says, "This is what happened. We're not going to make the situation rosier than it was. These people were terribly flawed. Jacob was flawed, Rachel was flawed, Leah was flawed. Everybody is flawed. More than that, they're sinners." So this is descriptive, showing that God, even in spite of all this, God is the one, because of his promise that he made to Abraham, God is the one that is blessing Jacob. He has given him provision, and now he has given him prosperity. But it doesn't end just with a family. Verse 25, it says, "As soon as Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, 'Send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, that I may go, for you know the service that I have given you.'" His second 7 years is up, and he's ready to leave. But Laban's like, it says in verse 27, "But Laban said to him, 'If I have found favor in your sight, I have learned by divination,'" ooh, superstition, something with the idols, some kind of cultural belief. Somehow he has understood, come to the conclusion that the reason he is being blessed is because of the association with Jacob. "I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages and I will give it." Sounds like a blank check. But we know with Laban that that's way too good to be true. So they make this arrangement that Jacob would now, as he works for Laban as a shepherd, he would keep any of the bred livestock that were multicolored. Any of the ones that were solid, like solid red, solid black, solid white, whatever, Laban would keep those, but Jacob would get the ones that came out speckled, spotted, multicolored. Verse 36, after Laban removes all of the speckled and spotted, so hopefully they won't bear more speckled and spotted, and the rest, he only gives Jacob the solid colored, unicolored ones to take care of. After he does that and makes that provision, verse 36, it says, and he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. And Jacob pastured the rest of Laban's flock. He's taking precautions to make sure that he is the one that's going to be keep gaining the wealth and not Jacob. Verse 37, then Jacob took fresh sticks of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white streaks in them, exposing the white of the sticks. And this is very curious. Verse 38, he set the sticks that he had peeled in front of the flocks and the troughs, that is, the watering places where the flocks came to drink, and since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the sticks, and so the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. What we have here is Jacob leaning on a superstitious belief, a cultural belief, one of these old wives' tales, one of these farmers' tales, that if you expose a vivid sight to an animal while it is pregnant or conceiving, it would have an effect on the embryo. But Jacob is going to understand later that it wasn't his practice of doing this that's going to bless. It was God the whole time. Verse 41, it says, whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob would lay the sticks in the troughs before the eyes of the flock that they might breed among the sticks. But for the feebler of the flock, he would not lay them there. So the feebler would be Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. Whether or not God actually used this superstitious belief of Jacob, the point is that that God is the one that is blessing him. It's not the superstition, it is him. In verse 43, it says, thus the man increased greatly and had large flocks, female servants and male servants, and camels. Camels was a sign of prosperity, a sign of being rich. Not everybody in that culture had camels, but he had camels and donkeys. God was the source of Jacob's blessing, and for this original audience, when they would recount this, recount these stories of how the tribes came to be and the prosperity of Jacob, they would know God was the source of Jacob's blessing, but God would also be the source of blessing for covenant Israel. Now, we look at this, and this practice that Jacob did is not, it's not repeatable today. All right? If you want a particular type of animal, you cut almond branches or poplar trees or whatever, it's not going to produce this. This is not repeatable because God was involved in this. But our prosperity, God is blessing Jacob materially, like he said he would do for Abraham and Abraham's descendants. Our prosperity, though, today, the way we must understand this, is that our prosperity that God gives us is not a material prosperity, but it's a prosperity of the soul. How do I know that? Well, in Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives the Beatitudes, and in the present tense, he uses this word, makarios, blessed, or happy. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are, present tense, are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. We could go on, but the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount are about a flourishing of the soul. And so, yes, God still today provides prosperity and his undeserved favor for us, but it's a prosperity of the soul. That doesn't mean we don't have seasons where we are depressed, distressed. But overall, it's a prosperity. I mean, even in 3 John, John writing to Gaius, elder, to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth, beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes with your soul. Even though Gaius was struggling physically, he was A-okay spiritually. So God does provide a flourishing of our souls. All right, thirdly, it is God's undeserved favor that provides protection. It is God's undeserved favor that provides protection. Verse 1, now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth. And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. Do you see God fulfilling his promise? It's been 20 years. But God is going to take him back to the land where he belongs. The land that God has promised to his father and his grandfather. So, verse 4, so Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was and said to them, I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. So Jacob worked for Laban Industries for 20 years, he got his reward. He got what he earned, his wages, for the first 7 years and the second 7 years. It's in these last 6 years that God starts blessing him like crazy and making him prosperous. Down in verse 11, we read, then the angel of God, he is retelling to his wives how God came to him. The angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift up your eyes and see. All the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. God's not like, hey, look, Jacob, the whole thing you did with the, cutting open the branches, that worked, good job. No, he says, I have seen. Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. So we have somebody coming from exile, returning to the land with opposition. Just like what happened for the Exodus generation when they came out. Verse 14, then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. How do we also know that God is in this? Well, the wives finally agree on something. Verse 17, so Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock, all his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Padan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban. Keeps coming up in the life of Jacob, and it's not over yet. Jacob tricked Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. After 20 years of friction, Jacob tries to quietly leave. And it also says here that Rachel stole her father's household gods, his teraphim. And the question we have to ask, why did Rachel steal these idols? Text doesn't necessarily say. A, it could be superstitious belief. B, it could be they had value. These could be sold. These could be traded with, marketed. Or thirdly, it could have just been for spite. Regardless, Rachel isn't presented very well here. Verse 22, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream by night and said to him, be careful. Laban is pursuing Jacob, and God comes to him in a dream by night and says, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. So God steps in for Jacob. He steps in like a wall. You remember when Israelites came out of Egypt and they get to the Red Sea, and here they are pinned at the Red Sea on one side, and on the other side is Pharaoh's rushing armies coming at them. And what happened? The pillar of cloud that God was manifesting himself in moved from leading them to being a wall between them and between the Egyptians and the Israelites. God steps in as a wall here for Jacob. God is Jacob's guide, and he is also Jacob's guardian. So Laban catches up after about 300 miles, and he comes and he puts on this show, right? Why did you sneak off? I would have thrown you a party. You didn't give me the opportunity to kiss my daughters and my grandbabies goodbye. Verse 30, and now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours and take it. Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Verse 33, so Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Uh-oh. Verse 34, now Rachel, see, Rachel's not dumb either. Everybody is in this business of tricking one another. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let my lord not be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household gods. Rachel says, I'm uncomfortable, I'm on my period right now, so I'm not going to get down. And he doesn't even think about checking the saddlebags. Now, whether or not she's lying about that really doesn't matter, but it does point out the weakness of idols, that they can be sat upon, first of all, and then they can be sat upon with someone who would later, under the law, be considered ritually unclean at that time of the month. And these idols are subject to that, as are all human idols. They're just subject to ridiculousness. Because God is the one that created the world. God is the one that leads, that called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is the one that brought the 10 plagues on the Egyptians, the Passover, part of the Red Sea. He is the only God. Verse 36a, it says, then Jacob became angry after Laban couldn't find anything, and he berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. Jacob realizes he's at a turning point in his life, or at least leading to a turning point, where he is finally seeing the hand of God. At some point, he's going to quit the lying. He's going to quit the deceiving. And so, here at the end of chapter 31, Laban and Jacob, they agree. They come to mutual agreement that, yeah, we can't trust each other. We need a covenant. So, Jacob and his man, Laban and his man, they all agree to this covenant over a meal. Now, let's land this plane this morning. We're not Israelites. We live in the church age, after the cross. What is all of this? Why does all of this matter? Well, I came across a quote by a guy named Leslie Newbegin, who I was not familiar with. He said this, If the biblical story does not control our thinking, then we will be swept into the story that the world tells about itself. Listen, it is essential to know what God has said and done in history. We have to know what God has said and done in history so that we are informed about how to honor Him in the present. How to understand His nature, how we are to relate to Him. To know who He is. And something that we find out about God in this whole retelling is undeserved favor. Yes, this is a crazy situation. And there's not a lot of noble stuff going on here. But what we have is God, Yahweh, faithful to His word, offering undeserved and providing undeserved favor. And listen, we have access to God. We have access to His caring watch and His blessings because of Jesus. Jacob had access to his undeserved blessings because of the word, the promise that he had made to Abraham. We have it because of the work that Christ did on Calvary. And listen, knowing what God has done in the past and what God is going to do in the future helps us to honor Him in the here and now. Believers, all of us that have put our faith and trust in Christ, listen, we are on a trajectory to reigning with Christ. Salvation, our salvation is undeserved from beginning to end. If your story was put in book form, like we have of Jacob, there would be plenty of embarrassing, shameful, sinful things that we would read about ourselves. But salvation is undeserved from beginning to end. I mean, God did the work. Jesus did it all. He went to the cross. He died in our place as a substitute. All we could ever offer God are filthy rags. But God made it possible that when we turn from doing things our own way, putting our faith and trust in Jesus, we become His child. So, really, all of this leads to this morning. I am calling upon each of us to acknowledge that it is this same God from Genesis 29 through 31. It is this same God who blesses us. And acknowledge that. It is not our intellect. It is not our planning. It is not even our hard work that gains material or spiritual blessings. Acknowledge God and literally, physically bow before Him in acknowledgement. I'm calling for more than just a position of the heart. It's worship Him based on who He is and His benevolence towards us. And you cannot worship Him without eventually physically bowing the knee. Which, by the way, everyone will do one day, whether of their accord or not of their accord. The worship team is going to come forward now. Would you stand to your feet? We've covered a lot of ground this morning, and I know it's taken us a while. But God's undeserved favor, no matter how God has blessed you this morning, and He has blessed us all, acknowledge that that blessing is from Him. It's from Him. Now, you may have material blessings. You may have financial blessings. You may have a nice house. You might have a nice car. You might have a nice portfolio. You may have all of that, but if you do not know Christ, you are still missing the greatest blessing that God has provided. By the way, it's the only way you can come to Him. That's it. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And I hope you're not missing that one blessing. Father, thank you for your kindness, your goodness. Thank you for the grace that you give us, that sustains us. Even in our down times, it is your sustaining power, your sustaining goodness, even when we don't feel it, appreciate it, or even see it. God, we do want to acknowledge that. We do want to acknowledge you this morning, and we want to lift up our hearts through our attitudes, through our emotions, our intellect, our will, and even physically offer you praise this morning, acknowledging that it is you and only you that bless us, and it's all because of undeserved favor. Thank you, Father. Worship team is going to sing a song. If you would like to make use of the altar this morning to pray with God, to maybe physically bow before Him this morning, taking time to do that. Maybe you are missing that one blessing. You've got it all, and you know it doesn't fulfill you, and you still don't have Christ. We'll be up here this morning. We'd love to talk with you. We'd love to pray with you. And there's others that can pray for other needs that are going on as well. So we open this up this morning as the worship team sings and leads us.